With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no. You move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for being with us here on Tactics, whether you're joining us on Facebook Live, on YouTube, on Twitter, Twitch, Periscope, however you're watching us. We certainly appreciate you being with us today, and we appreciate you being a part of the program here on Tactics, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. So today on the program, I know that we're kicking off a little bit earlier than we normally do, but that's because I've got a function at church. For those of you that have been listening to the show the past couple weeks, you know that I'm about to head off to the Ukraine, and that involves a lot of packing and preparation to bring over the humanitarian aid. So we're going to be doing that earlier today. Because of that, I have to leave a little early, so we're going to be broadcasting a little early, and thank you so much for being with us at this special time. And as you all know, on Wednesday, we try to make it a point to do things of a more spiritual nature, still involving the news, still talking about culture and politics, but we try to aim it a little bit more in the religious theological direction. And my guest today is absolutely perfect for that. I actually had never heard of him before the other day, met him here at a lecture at Faulkner University, and a very prestigious professor. He is a professor of political science at George Fox University and has a new book coming out, which unfortunately I have not had time to read yet because, like I said, I just met this guy yesterday. But if it's anything like his lectures would imply that it is, very scholarly, very thoughtful, and thought-provoking, because it's different from a lot of the things that you normally hear. And so here is my guest joining us right now on the program, Dr. Mark Hall. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Caleb.
Well, it is certainly great to have you here with us, and we appreciate you being generous with your time. So just real quick, because we know that you've written this book, you've written other books, you've written for the Heritage Foundation. Give us some background on this book and sort of what inspired you to put this together and why you think it's important for people to pick up.
Sure. So I've written or edited a dozen books for academic presses, including Oxford University Press and Cambridge University Press, mostly on the question of religion in the American founding, and specifically Christianity's role in America's founding. And these books have been well received by scholars, but pretty much they've only been read by scholars. So in this forthcoming book, Did America Have a Christian Founding? It will be published by Nelson Books, and it's aimed at the general reading public. So basically, I'm trying to bring these scholarly arguments to the general reading public, to thoughtful Christians who read serious books, who are interested in this question of religion in the American founding, religious liberty, church-state relations, and that sort of thing.
So it's the same sort of scholarly approach, you've just made it a little bit more digestible to the average reader?
Yeah, I would like to think it's a lot more digestible. So if someone enjoys reading, say, a biography of Alexander Hamilton or George Washington, you know, this should be at that same sort of level. So it's serious, but not overly scholarly. I don't engage in jargon. I don't, you know, try to point out how I'm different from this scholar and that scholar. I just make good, solid, straightforward arguments based on primary sources. And again, I'd like to think it's very accessible.
You know, I think that that's actually more important, and I think that it is actually more scholarly to use primary sources, because I think a lot of the problems that sometimes our historians run into is that they get to this point where they're almost in an echo chamber where they're just quoting other historians as their backup, and they don't actually know if the primary sources back up their claims.
You know, that can happen. And even if they aren't doing that, scholarly works oftentimes will just spend so much time explaining how your position is slightly different from that position and a lot different from that position. Mm-hmm. And that's just uninteresting to people who don't know the scholarly literature. It's important in its own way, and I've done that sort of thing, but not in this book.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about this because I know that this is something that's important to my audience. Why is there a movement, and you talked about this the other day in your lecture, why is it that there is this movement that seems so intent upon and seems to have such a vested interest in spreading the idea that we did not have a Christian founding? Why do you think that idea has become so prominent in certain circles?
You know, I think there's a couple of different reasons. One reason is that there's a tendency of scholars to focus on the most famous of the founders. And when you look at someone like a Thomas Jefferson, a Ben Franklin, a John Adams, in fact, these founders are more influenced by the Enlightenment than our most founders. And of course, Jefferson and Adams and Franklin spent a significant time over in Europe. And we know for sure that Franklin, Jefferson, Adams are not Orthodox Christians, at least by the end of their lives. And so if you only look at these most prominent of founders, you might get a view of the founding generation that really is quite different from if you look at the broader constellation of men, mostly men, a few women, who debated the Declaration of Independence, who debated the federal constitution, who debated the Bill of Rights, who debated ratifying these things. So you know, if you think about all those communities I mentioned, we're up to 800, 900 founders now. And when you look at this broader constellation of founders, what you see are a lot of Orthodox Christians who are drawing from the deeply held Christian convictions when they're engaging in these founding acts.
Okay, so a couple things that I want to sort of get some clarification on from that. First of all, I will say that before I even get into the question, I do applaud you in looking at some of the other founders, because you're right. We tend to focus on just, you know, a very select few of the founders. And I was astounded the other day. I was talking to someone actually after your talk here, and I was like, you know, it's rare that I even run into somebody that even knows who Roger Sherman is. Like, nine times out of 10, they're like, didn't he play for the Cowboys? No, that's Roger Staubach.
Right.
Like, but you think about it, he signed virtually every founding document. He's a very important figure around that time, and most people don't even know who he is.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, he's really one of the most important of America's statesmen. Let me just give you a quick story. In 1776, there are three key committees in the Continental Congress: the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence, the committee to draft the Articles of Confederation, and the Board of War. Sherman is on all three of those committees. Thomas Jefferson is a relatively young pup. He's only on one of the committees, the committee to draft the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
Yeah, and so he does take the lead on that, but somehow we give him like all the credit for this document. But this five-person committee, of which Sherman was one of the five, had an important influence, and then the rest of Congress did as well. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, when we look at a document like the Declaration, we have to look at the 55 or so odd men who debated it and the 39 or so who actually signed it. We can't just look at Thomas Jefferson and think he reflects the entire meaning of the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, and I think that when it comes to Jefferson, part of his fame is because he's such a prolific writer. Part of it is because he did become president at some point, and he's just an incredibly fascinating person. But I really want to get to some of the background, because one of the things that you said that I think that there's solid evidence for, but I just want to hear your take on it. Why do you think it is? Why are you saying that Franklin and Jefferson and Adams were not, quote, Orthodox Christians? What exactly does that mean, and how do you back that up with those three men in particular?
Yeah, so by Orthodox Christianity, I mean just basic Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, you know, basic Christianity. God exists, Jesus Christ is God, the Trinity, miracles, that sort of thing. And what we have in private correspondence, and these men are very careful to keep their views from the public eye, but we have letters where Thomas Jefferson, for instance, clearly rejects the idea of the Trinity, the Incarnation, the Virgin Birth, you know, all sorts of basic tenets of Christianity. Now, he is a deist of sorts. He believes in a creator God. He may even believe, he mentions on occasion, God intervening in human affairs, which would mean he's not your usual sort of deist.
Right.
But
that would kind of fly
in
the face to common deist doctrine.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. But we do know, I mean, there's just no doubt that he, at least later in life, was not an Orthodox Christian. For Franklin, we have similar documents from earlier in life, and Adams, again, a bit later in life. So we know this for sure, but what's striking, and this is amazingly striking, is when you leave those three, almost always, someone like a George Washington, a James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton are also called deist, and yet I know of literally no place where any of those three deny any basic tenet of Orthodox Christianity. They don't call themselves deist, and you know, from all appearances, there's no good reason to call them a deist. And then when we leave these six famous founders and go to the rest of them, to your Samuel Adams, your Patrick Henrys, your Roger Shermans, your Oliver Ellsworth, and on and on and on I could go, we have very, very good reasons for believing that these men are Orthodox Christians who are working within the bounds of Orthodox Christianity when they're breaking from Great Britain and creating a new constitutional order.
Yeah, and I think that an important distinction to make here is that even though I think that we could kind of debate back and forth on whether they were, how Christian they were, how Orthodox Christian they were, whether or not they were deist or not, I think that with Franklin, he actually was more deist at the beginning of his life and kind of got more in the idea of divine providence the later you get in his life, whereas Jefferson kind of went in the opposite direction. But either way, I think that it's important to note that for scholars that are interested in this, that there is a difference in a deist and a secularist. And I think that you could make at least some arguments for men like Jefferson and Franklin being deist. I don't think that you could make any argument that they were secularist or wanted to whitewash Christianity out of society or even out of government in many cases.
No, that's absolutely right. There's just no reason to believe any of these folks are secularist or atheist. And actually, in the first chapter of my book, I make a good argument that if we take the usual definition of deism, then I think there may be only one civic leader in the American founding who's a deist, and that's Ethan Allen. Thomas Paine would be the only other one you might count, but I'm not even sure we should count him as an American because he's born in England. He spends most of his life, the vast majority of his life, over in Europe. He does come over to America and do some important stuff, but I think he's questionably an American. So maybe one, two, maybe three civic founders who are deist. And then beyond that, we have plenty of evidence, and I provide a lot of this evidence drawing from the primary sources, that in fact there are very, very good reasons to believe that many of the founders were Orthodox Christians. And even more important, as you know, I'm primarily focusing on influence, and right. I think that the argument that Christian ideas had a profound influence on the founders is just a knockout argument.
Well, speaking of that, you said something yesterday in your lecture that just fascinated me, and I'd like for you to expound upon that. When talking about Franklin specifically, and I know that you actually work at a university that is sort of rooted in the Quaker tradition, so I find it really interesting that you see a real evolution of Franklin and his ideology after he moves to Philadelphia from Boston. And so I was wondering just what sort of being in that environment, what effects you think it might have had on Franklin's, you know, religion, his political philosophy, if you could just kind of speak to that for a moment.
Yes, I do. I do a little bit of work on Franklin in the book. As a young man in England, like in the 1720s, he writes an essay where he actually, questions whether there really is a difference between good and evil, which is, of course, a radically unchristian idea, but it's not a deist idea. Deists actually are sort of doubling down on the importance of morality. Then he comes back to America, and in his autobiography, he actually says, as a young man, I became a deist. But in his autobiography, he goes on to say, but I recognized that this was a very pernicious doctrine, so I stopped talking about it. And then, I can't give you the exact timeline, but it sure seems after the 1760s, I think you're absolutely right, that he's drifting in the direction of orthodoxy. He certainly seems to believe that God intervenes in the affairs of men and nations. He says so clearly in the Constitutional Convention. In a late in life letter to Ezra Stiles, he says, well, I still have doubts about the divinity of Christ, but I guess I'll find out soon enough. So that's why I would not classify him as an Orthodox Christian even late in life, but certainly moving in that direction, and who knows where he ended up exactly.
You know, I think a little bit of that, and you kind of hinted at it in that answer, I think a part of the reason that secularists and people that have a very, agnostic to atheist worldview sometimes do mischaracterize our founders as being secularist or agnostic is because I think it's kind of a bias that they have, because in their mind, the only people that do question things like morality, question God, question religious practices, that the only person that can do that is somebody that is an agnostic or an atheist. And they kind of think that Christians don't struggle with these things or never question this. And that's why when they see people like Franklin and Jefferson questioning these things, they think, oh, well, they must be an agnostic or an atheist or a secularist of some kind.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And so they might be drawn to people who seem more likely to be doing this sort of thing. And in fact, they might read him or read them or interpret them in light of what they want to see. Let me add another reason to go back to your very first question. I think in some instances, what you have are professors and jurists, I'll throw in jurists here, judges, who are looking for a usable past. So particularly I'll pick on Supreme Court justices in the mid-20th century. I think for reasons completely unrelated to the American founding, they decided that we should have the separation of church and state. And so they went back to the founding era and more or less engaged in law office history. They said, okay, what documents suggest that the founders wanted a strict separation of church and state? Oh, look, here's this letter from Thomas Jefferson to Danbury Baptist, where he talks about the First Amendment creating a wall of separation between church and state. And, oh, look, here's a detached memorandum, a document James Madison wrote after he left the presidency, where he questions the constitutionality of legislative prayer and chaplains. Mm-hmm. And so Supreme Court justices latch onto these documents because they bring about policy outcomes they wanted to see. Whereas I think the idea that America's founders wanted the strict separation of church and state is completely ahistorical. It's completely wrong. Even Jefferson and Madison, who wanted a greater degree of separation than most founders, even they, in their public activities, did not act as if the Constitution requires a strict separation of church and state, or indeed that it is even a good thing. So even before we have the First Amendment, they didn't act as if that we shouldn't have presidential calls for prayer or congressional calls for prayer or legislative chaplains. James Madison votes to pay legislative chaplains, both in the Confederation Congress and the First Federal Congress. I mean, it's just a bad historical argument, but separationists are looking for a usable history.
You know, what you're describing there sounds an awful lot like something that a lot of the people in my audience will be familiar with from a theological standpoint, something called proof texting, where you basically start out with an idea of what you want the Bible to say, and then you start perusing it for verses that back up what you already believed, as opposed to reading the Bible and making your decision based on the content.
You know, that's exactly right. I think that's a great analogy.
Well, one thing that I wanted to ask, and you actually kind of halfway segued into it, you know, I'm in the state of Alabama. I've got to ask you about Hugo Black. So
sure.
Just since you were talking about that and talking about jurists and sort of them retroactively giving a continuity that doesn't exist, talk about Hugo Black and his influence in how we see separation of church and state today.
Sure. I touched on this briefly in my forthcoming book, Did America Have a Christian Founding? But I'm already working on a sequel to it where I spend a lot of time on this. So if I am right, and there's no good argument from the American founding that the founders wanted the separation of church and state, the question becomes, when did this enter into American political discourse? And what I argue there, and here I'm borrowing from the work of Philip Hamburger and others, is it really comes about in the mid-19th century as a result of anti-Catholicism, that basically the public schools were Protestant schools, and when Catholics came along and said, hey, give us a share of our tax dollars so we can have Catholic schools,
right,
or at least let us read from the Catholic version of the Bible, all of a sudden the Protestants said, oh, no, we can't do that because of the separation of church and state. So this anti-Catholicism is immediately connected to this rise of the doctrine of separation, and is connected in an excellent way to Hugo Black, who as a relatively young man is a member of the KKK.
Right.
As a Supreme Court justice, he loves the works of Paul Blanchard, who's one of the most anti-Catholic writers in the mid-20th century. No one knows him anymore, but he was very influential. And he's actually cited in several Supreme Court opinions by justices arguing for this strict separation of church and state. And so Hamburger argues, and I agree, that a lot of what you, where you see the separationists coming from is anti-Catholicism. And the Protestants are real happy to go along with this until the 1960s, when the Supreme Court sort of does a double fake and all of a sudden starts kicking teacher-led prayer out of the public school and public Bible reading out of the public schools. And now the Protestants are shocked. They say, this is not what we meant.
Yeah.
And this sets the stage for the later cooperation that we now see between Catholics and Protestants, especially evangelical-type Protestants, in politics. We still have important disagreements, that is, evangelicals and Catholics, important theological disagreements. I don't mean to downplay those, right, but in terms of a lot of the key public issues of the day, school vouchers, abortion, mm-hmm. same-sex marriage, you know, we can cooperate in the public square quite effectively sometimes.
You know, I think that that is correct, because in my private study of Hugo Black and his history, I mean, the first case that really he made a name for himself was him sentencing a man because he had married a Protestant girl and he was a Catholic. So, like, there's a pretty clear anti-Catholic bend from Black early on. And I think that a part of that, and a part of that that is so important, is this is why I always warn people about the dangers of big government in general. Because when big government is going against somebody you don't like, it's all sunshine and rainbows until all of a sudden you realize that they can use the same excuses they use to attack one group to attack you. And that's exactly what seems to have happened with the Protestants in that era that you're talking about.
You know, I think that's exactly right. That's very well put. And so, you know, really, Roman Catholics, I think it's fair to say they were being discriminated against because of their religious convictions. And you're exactly right. Protestants were just fine with that until all of a sudden, bam. Now, you know, nowadays, you know, 100 years later almost, we're seeing, I think in many ways, religious people being discriminated against. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of an uphill battle in some instances, fighting for religious liberty, especially in the blue states, of course. That's where a lot of the toughest battles are coming. And if we had worked in cooperation early on, and this is one of the themes of my book, that I do believe the founders embraced a very robust understanding of religious liberty that protects all Americans. And that's why today we should be fighting for the religious liberty of evangelicals and Catholics and Muslims and Sikhs. These things, they sink or swim together. And it's important that we have a principled approach to religious liberty and not just be concerned when it's our own denomination that is being threatened.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I mean, that's a subject that we could go on for probably another hour on, but I know I promised I'd get you out of here pretty quickly, so I will ask one last question, if you don't mind, because this is one you hear a lot, or at least you do if you've debated the influence of Christianity in the founding. The you touched on it yesterday, too, so I wanted you to sort of expound upon that. The nature's God argument, where people say that because Jefferson was using phrases like nature's God or supreme creator, things that aren't seemingly a direct reference to the God of the Bible, that that somehow suggests that there was not a uniquely Christian founding. So if you could just sort of explain that a little bit.
Sure. I have a good little section in my book on this very question. Yeah, nature's God in a sort of abstract sense might sound a little deistic, but the reality is, it was used all the time. Isaac Watts, the founder of the English hymnody, uses it in a poem. And certainly things like creator and providence are just used all the time. In fact, I go through the Westminster Catechism, a very important Reformed catechism, and I pull out a lot of labels that might seem somewhat deistic, things like the first cause. And yet nobody doubts the Orthodox Christianity of the men who wrote the Westminster Confession, mm-hmm. both over in England and then in the American revision. Yeah, so it's just a bad argument by people who don't know better. Again, if you haven't dug into the primary sources, people might not be trying to lie to you. They might actually believe what they're saying.
Right.
But a historian who has spent good time in the primary sources cannot say that using something like creator or father or something like that to refer to God is a deistic way to refer to God. You know, we do that all the time. Oh, and, you know, maybe not so much creator, but certainly back in that era, I think they did.
Yeah, and another thing too with that, and a lot of it I do think is because just people haven't even read the entirety of the Declaration of Independence. That very document, in the last line, it's with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, which is not something that a deist would have thought of.
No, not.
Yeah, but anyway, so thank you so much for being generous with your time, Dr. Hall. How do people get a copy of this book?
You know, you can go to pretty much anywhere you can buy books online, and the few bookstores that are remaining. Probably the easiest way, in all honesty, is just go to Amazon and under title, Did America Have a Christian Founding? And it would be great if people would pre-order it. It comes out in about 2 weeks, and that would be much appreciated.
All right. Well, I'll certainly try to get a copy myself, and I know that there's going to be a lot of my listeners that are really interested in this subject. So thank you so much for your time. We appreciate you joining us here on the program.
Hey, thank you very much, Caleb. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Hall. You have a good day.
Thanks. You too.
All right. That is, of course, Dr. Mark Hall. He is a professor at George Fox University and has a new book coming out, Did America Have a Christian Founding? Which, I got to tell you, when it comes to the subject, you guys know I'm just a huge nerd when it comes to history around the founding era, especially as it pertains to religious liberty. And so I would love to spend all day with him, but I've got places to go. I know he's got places to go. We're going to have to go ahead and wrap up the show for today. But thank you so much for being with us. And I'll be back tomorrow for one last show before I head off to the Ukraine. In the meantime, stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.